the sun, but it is not so big nor so intense. It is also colder there, though not in a bad way. Everything is clearer and cleaner, bigger and yet sharper somehow. No smog, huh? Cedric shook his head, though Liv wasn't quite sure he even knew what smog was. It is both simpler there and more complicated in some ways. We ride in carriages to get from the palace to the town, and we hunt in giant forests with trees that reach as tall as that. Liv followed Cedric's finger to where it pointed at a series of hills. Taller, actually. What do you do for fun? Besides hunting, we go to feasts and dances on high holidays, but we also just spend time together. Like, hang out. Cedric shrugged. He was still staring at the sky, but it didn't look like he was really seeing it. His eyes were much farther away. And what about Kat? Liv asked, trying to keep her voice light. What about her? Well, the whole lifelong betrothal thing, it's kind of difficult to understand. We don't really do that here. Not in LA, anyway. Kat and I, that is simply the way it has always been for us. They were silent again, and Liv could hear crickets chirping from the trees. The air around her felt thick. What about love? She asked, her voice low. Doesn't that exist in Calum? Of course it does. But Kat and I, we are different. We have responsibilities to our families, to our nation. Our union will make our entire kind stronger against the rising wrath forces. Oh, Liv managed. She wasn't sure what else to say. It seemed like a lot for a teenager to take on. Cedric's eyebrows stitched together as if he was trying to work something out. Kat and I are lucky. We have always cared for each other, which is more than a lot of people in our position can say. I trust her more than anyone. Liv tried to think about the people in her life she really trusted. Just Shannon, really. Joe, too, although she didn't really want to think about him right now, or the half-dozen voicemails he'd left on her phone. I get it, she said. But do you think you two will still... I mean, if you don't get back, we are getting back. Cedric's voice was firm. Right, sorry. I didn't mean... Of course. Cedric shook his head, but his tone had changed. He stared off into the distance again, his expression hard. Liv felt something strange then, just an all-consuming need to make him feel better somehow, to erase the past few moments. I can help you, if you want. Almost startled, Cedric looked over at her. You have already helped. I mean, I can help you track down the the scrolls. I assume you've Googled them already? Cedric just raised an eyebrow, and Liv took that as a no. Right. Well, we can start with that. Tomorrow morning, we'll go pick up my car. It has my laptop in it. And we'll do some research. Can't promise anything, but there's all sorts of crazy stuff on the internet. Who knows? Some of it might even be true. Cedric still looked confused. The internet. Liv didn't think she was up to the task of explaining how computers worked to someone who'd never even used a cell phone before. I keep forgetting how much I have to teach you. She tilted her head and put on a mock condescending voice. So innocent. Cedric smiled. Not so innocent. I am sure I could teach you a thing or two as well. Cedric's eyes widened as though he'd just realized what he'd said. I only meant... Liv looked away quickly, hoping her face wasn't turning strange shades of red. No, I know. You could probably teach me how to use a bow and arrow or something. Exactly. Yes, that is what I meant. Cedric's voice was still a bit high-pitched, but the worst of the embarrassment seemed behind them. For now.
Do you really not know how to hunt at all?
Not unless you count going through the Fat Burger drive-thru, Liv replied weakly.
My sister, Emmeline, could hold a bow properly by the time she was 7 years old.
Cedric chuckled to himself. She loved that bow so much. It was a birthday gift from my father. She used to actually sleep with it in her bed. One day I accidentally stepped on it and broke it. When I told her, I was holding it in pieces, and I thought she was going to burst into tears. Instead, she punched me. Right here. Cedric pointed a finger to his nose. My father just laughed, said no one would ever mess with his daughter. Cedric's smile faltered. Liv swallowed.
Sounds like a nice family.
They are my home, Cedric said, his voice almost a whisper. He cleared his throat, as though eager to change the subject. Though I am sure everyone feels that way about their family. Cedric looked up quickly, his eyes apologetic.
I am sorry. I forgot your family.
For a while, Liv didn't respond. She felt a familiar lump rise in her throat, and then got angry with herself, angry that her body could still react in this way, even after all these years. Cedric lifted his hand up and moved it a few inches closer to where her hand rested against the plastic arm of the chair, but then pulled it back. He didn't ask, but Liv knew the story was coming up anyway.
There was a fire when I was 6, Liv said, tentative.
Both of my parents died. I had a brother and a sister, too, but we were split up. No foster family wanted to take all of us. I've been on my own since then. This time Cedric did reach out and take her hand. His skin felt warm in the cool night air. He wrapped his fingers around hers and held them there.
I truly am sorry, he said.
It was a long time ago, Liv said, breathing in deep. The lump in her throat was almost gone now. Besides, I just lost my family.
You lost your whole world.
Cedric looked down at their hands, pressed together in the darkness.
Seems like the same thing to me.
They didn't talk for a while after that, but sat in stillness, watching the few stars that were visible in the sky and listening to each other breathe. Liv didn't remember closing her eyes, but the next thing she knew, she was waking up and looking around at the backyard, which was full of light. She looked down at her hand, but Cedric was no longer holding it. His own hand had fallen down and was dangling against the edge of his lawn chair. It was close enough to reach out and grab, and yet felt very far away. After staring at it for a moment, she curled up in her chair in the sunshine, feeling a small ache in her chest she couldn't begin to explain. The Makings of a Plan. Later that morning, Liv's biggest hurdle was trying to convince Cedric not to bring a sword on the L.A. City bus. He'd insisted on going with her to pick up her car, just in case there were any wraiths still in the area. He also insisted on being prepared.
We can't just get on a bus holding a deadly blade the size of a baseball bat, Liv argued. It is a sword.
I know that, Liv took a deep breath to start again. I'm trying to explain how insane you'll look. It isn't insane to be ready for our enemies.
Okay, sure. But how do I tell that to the kindly bus driver who thinks she might chop his head off?
I doubt this blade is sharp enough to chop anyone's head off.
Now you're just intentionally missing my point.
Cedric grinned. Eventually, he'd agreed to wrap a large trash bag around the weapon to hide it. He still looked like a crazy person, but one who would at least cause less panic.
Cedric had hoped to retrieve his few belongings and remaining food from the museum while Liv got her car. When they got to the alley, however, they saw the way was blocked off by a police cruiser and a line of bright yellow crime scene tape. "They won't be there forever," Liv told Cedric as he narrowed his eyes in the direction of the alleyway. He sighed heavily and got into her car. From the museum, Liv made a trip to the ATM, bought some water and blankets for the house, and dodged more of Joe's calls. Running errands helped clear her head a bit and made her feel useful again. Whenever she wondered whether it was a good idea to help out Cedric and his friends, and maybe put herself in danger in the process, she just remembered the alternative plan. Call Joe, get placed in a new home, start from scratch, following another stranger's rules, and eating another stranger's food. Staying at the Echo Park house seemed like a pretty good idea by comparison. At least she'd be making her own decisions, even if those decisions involved arguing with a cute, otherworldly prince about the safest way to hold a sword in a moving car. Plus, she didn't like the thought of abandoning them now. On the way back to the house, Liv drove through the In-N-Out drive-thru. By mid-afternoon, she and the others sat sprawled out across the living room, surrounded by red and white discarded burger wrappers and soda cups. Liv had changed into fresh jeans, a tank top, and a light jacket, and had lent a t-shirt to Kat as well. The boys still had to wear their clothes from the day before. "We should go back to the museum tonight to retrieve our belongings," Kat said. She was studying the plastic top to her soda cup, pulling the straw in and out. "It will be easier under the cover of darkness." Cedric nodded, but his mouth was too full of burger to respond. Liv had her laptop open, and in between bites of fries was working to connect to a neighbor's unprotected Wi-Fi system. Finally, one hit. Bingo. She pulled up a search box and typed in Calum and scrolls. She could feel Merrick over her shoulder, looking intently at the screen. "It's magic, then?" he asked as the screen popped up with search results. "No," Liv said, her eyes on the screen. "It's Wi-Fi." "What is the difference?" Liv tilted her head. "Electrons? Shh, I'm concentrating." The first few links to come up on the page were obvious misfires. One was for a popular fantasy video game, and one was a fan page for an actor named Tyler Callum, whose name was misspelled on at least three occasions throughout the site. Cedric came to sit on her other side, and their shoulders touched. The heat from his arm radiated out to hers. It was a bit distracting. Liv tried to keep her arm that was next to Cedric's still as she scrolled down the list of links. She was afraid that by moving it or calling attention to it in any way, Cedric might move a few inches away and take the warmth with him. Eventually, she came to one from the University of California, San Diego. It was a link to a professor's biography page, but the word Calum was featured in its two-sentence description. On the page, the professor's name, Leonard Billings, Ph.D., was in bold type next to a picture of an older man with dark skin, a big smile, and a scraggly white beard. Professor Billings taught a class in ancient cultures and myths, from the Greeks to the Celtic Druids. Liv continued to scroll down through a list of the required reading materials for students. At the very bottom of the page was a blurb with the professor's own qualifications, including the title of a dissertation he had written, Origins of the Knights of Valair, and the search for Calum's scrolls. "What are the Knights of Valair?" Liv asked. "It does not sound familiar," Cedric shrugged, and the movement of his arm against Liv's raised goosebumps on her skin. She hoped he didn't notice. She hoped Kat didn't notice either. "Do you have knights in Calum?" "Yes," Cedric replied, matter of fact. "But Valair, never heard of them." Liv went back to Google's main page and typed the professor's name into the search box along with the word Calum. Only one more site came up, and it contained an abstract from the professor's dissertation. Liv read, The ultimate representation of this ancient belief system exists in the legend of Kalem, a fantastical realm that is connected to our own, but that cannot be accessed without a key, represented in this instance by a series of secret or hidden scrolls. Much like the Nordic myths of the mystical land of Asgard, Kalem is a concept brought into being by ancient pagans and perpetuated into the early Middle Ages. There the text cut off. The site went on to explain that the actual dissertation was available for purchase in hard copy from the UC San Diego bookstore. "It doesn't say much," Liv murmured. She clicked back to the main search screen, but couldn't find anything else helpful. She tried typing in Knights of Valair, but kept getting linked to websites authored by conspiracy nuts, with pages that featured white text on a black screen, and that focused in alien abductions and robots in the White House. "This professor seems to be the best lead," she said. "We should find him," Cedric said. "Well, San Diego isn't that far away, just a couple of hours. Maybe I could drive you in the morning?" Cedric's hand gripped the sword that lay by his side. "We have several more hours of sunlight left. Let us go now." Liv sighed. "I guess now works, too. But we're leaving all swords behind. This isn't a wrath we're facing, it's a college professor. And I don't want to get arrested for walking into some old guy's office with a 2-foot blade and a hefty bag." "Liv," Cedric started. "No," Liv crossed her arms. "I'm serious. I'm the one with the car, and if you want to get to San Diego by tonight, we go without an armory." Cedric drew in a long breath. "Fine." Kat gave him a hard, calculating look, but then nodded as well. "Let us go, then." Cedric turned to Kat. "I think it might be best if you and Merrick stay here." Kat's expression was one of disbelief. "What?" "You were right earlier that we need to retrieve our belongings from the museum, but it is more than that. I have been thinking about what Merrick suggested, back in the tunnels of the museum," Cedric said quickly, talking over Kat's shocked sputters. Merrick turned one cool glance in his direction. "Last night was not simply a few rats tracking our whereabouts. It was a whole group, and they were on the attack. I do not think we can sit back and wait for them to find us again. Now we need to track them, picking up their trail from the museum. And it cannot wait another night, else the trail might fade." Cedric fixed his eyes on Kat. "You are one of the best trackers I know, Kat. If anyone can find a wrath and determine where they are coming from and what they want, it's you." Kat appeared torn. She was nearly glowing from Cedric's praise, but her eyes darted back and forth between Liv and Cedric, sitting side by side on the couch. "And the two of you will journey alone?" Merrick smiled. "Ah, and the true purpose of the mission becomes clear." "Merrick, enough," Cedric said. But he got up, moving away from Liv. The cold rushed into the space where he'd been, and Liv tried not to let her disappointment show. Cedric walked to Kat and touched her lightly on the arm. "We will be back tonight, hopefully with more information about the scrolls. The sooner we can find them, the sooner we can get home." "And leave this place forever?" Kat said. Her words had a challenge in them, but Liv had a hard time understanding the conversation that Kat seemed to be having with Cedric just under the surface. Their eyes were speaking a hidden language, the way that only two people who had known each other a very long time could do. "Yes," Cedric finally said. "Forever." Something twisted in Liv's stomach, just for a moment, and she turned her head away. At the same time, the tension went out of Kat's shoulders. She exhaled and murmured, "Going off to the Roths is a good plan." "It's a brilliant plan," Merrick said, kicking his legs up over the edge of the couch. "Which is what I said when I thought of it yesterday." Cedric and Kat rolled their eyes at exactly the same time. "Will you go with Kat and provide backup?" Cedric asked. Merrick shrugged one shoulder, but didn't say no. Cedric turned to Liv. "Are you ready?" His eyes looked bright and almost fevered, the way they had just before he'd fought the rats. He had a mission again. "Sure," Liv said, trying to convey an excitement she didn't feel. "Let's get this show on the road."
"Show?"
Cedric asked. Liv sighed, heavy. "Never mind." The Questing. Cedric was getting used to riding in cars. When Liv first pulled onto the main thoroughfare she referred to as the Five, one look at the number of cars rushing toward them and past them at such an incredible speed made Cedric regret the second animal-style hamburger he'd eaten at the house. But after traveling for an hour, he was getting used to the feel of sitting still while the entire world flew by, almost too fast to see. Right out his window were trees and fences and houses and ocean, all blurring together and connected by an odd series of black wires that cut through the sky. He had to admit, the sight was almost beautiful. So often in this realm, Cedric had to grapple with confounding mysteries. Who put those black wires there? And for what possible purpose? But when he stopped trying to puzzle it out, he found this world could be surprisingly interesting to look at. In calm moments, it was breathtaking. Cedric turned to Liv and began to study the slight movements she made to control the vehicle. It didn't take much. Just one hand on the wheel, one foot working controls. Much easier than controlling horse-drawn carts, actually. Just as soon as she got used to the speed. "What does this do?" he asked, pointing to a lever between the seats that could move between different slots, labeled P, D, and R. Liv smiled and explained, going on to answer more of his questions about various buttons, pulleys, and keys, as well as the GPS on the dash that directed them where to go.
"Does not seem all that difficult, really," Cedric said.
"Nice try, but no way are you driving my car." Cedric shrugged. "What's this?" He reached over and turned a dial, and suddenly the car was filled with a noise that rolled and pounded through his skull.
"That's music!"
Liv yelled as she leaned over to twist the dial. The noise level fell instantly.
"Music? You call that music?"
Liv shook her head. "Not just music. The Beatles. I'm guessing you've never heard of them?"
"Cannot say that I have," Cedric countered.
"But then again, you have never heard of the Rattling Quartet."
"The what?"
"The most famous and talented group of musicians in our kingdom. My mother had them play for Em's 14th birthday feast." Cedric looked back out the window, smiling at the memory.
"It was a surprise. I'll never forget the look on her face when she came down the grand stairway, and the quartet started up with Love Song in Green, and dedicated it to Princess Emmeline. She turned white as a sheet, nearly tripped over her own gown coming down the steps. I teased her about that for a week."
Liv smiled, a far-off look in her eyes, as if she too could see his memory. Cedric replayed it in his mind, the way his father had taken his sister's hand and led her through the first dance. He'd later snuck swigs of his father's wine when no one was looking, and then danced all night with the pretty twin daughters of the aging Duchess Carol.
"What did they sound like?" Liv asked.
Cedric struggled to think how to describe it, the twinkling sounds of the instruments that floated across the airy ballroom, the almost ethereal voice of the singer, a young woman with braids that twisted down almost to her knees. He could just barely make out the melody of the song in his own mind, but he didn't know enough about musical terms to explain it to Liv.
"It sounded like summer," he finally said.
Liv just nodded, as if she knew exactly what he meant. Cedric looked out the window again, but this time, instead of seeing lines of black wire or the endless blue sky, he could only see Em's face. The sneaky grin she used to wear when she stole Cedric's toasted bread right from his plate at the breakfast table. The terror in her eyes just moments before Cedric stepped through the portal. He wondered what she was doing now, Was his family chained up at this moment, dreading whatever future awaited them? Was Em getting enough to eat for breakfast? Was she missing him? "Do you ever think about your brother and sister?" Cedric asked. Liv stared straight ahead, her eyes focused on the road. If the sound of his own voice hadn't still been ringing in his ears, Cedric would have wondered if she'd heard him at all. "I try not to," she finally said, her voice barely above a whisper. Something in the set of Liv's jaw warned him to let it alone, but then he thought of Em's face again, and how he would do anything to get back to where she was. "But are they not still alive?" Liv swallowed. "We were split up after the fire," she said, her hands gripping the steering wheel. "I suppose I could go through the records at social services, track them down if I wanted. I think my caseworker, Joe, would help me, but..." Liv paused in bitter lip. "Why would you not look for them? If I knew I had family near, and that I could find them..." Cedric's voice warbled off. "You could find them." Liv stared straight ahead. "They probably wouldn't want me to." "I do not understand. Is this another Earth custom?" "No, it's..." Liv swallowed, and for a while she didn't speak. Then she sighed, and her story flowed out of her as if a dam had broken. "I used to be afraid of the dark when I was a kid. It was pretty bad, actually. My older brother, Peter, he used to watch these horror movies late at night in his room, ones with killer dolls and evil leprechauns. Definitely not kid-appropriate. And I used to sneak into his room at night and watch them with him, even though I knew I wasn't supposed to. I started having these nightmares, and every morning I would tell myself that I would stop watching, but every night I was, like, compelled to go back for more. I had to watch what Peter was watching, you know?" Liv shook her head a little and smiled. Still, she kept her eyes locked straight ahead, and in the intense sunshine coming in through the car's front window, they looked more golden than green-brown. "Anyway, I developed this terrible fear of the dark. I started keeping a flashlight in my nightstand, just in case I had to get up and go to the bathroom in the middle of the night." Cedric tried to picture a younger version of Liv, vulnerable and afraid. It was difficult to do. "One night, I got up and grabbed for the flashlight, but it wouldn't turn on. The batteries were dead. So I went into my closet and opened up this secret shoebox of stuff I had. Just, you know, old arrowheads and junk like that." Cedric didn't know, but he didn't say anything. "I had this old lighter of Peter's, one he had from his Boy Scout days. I used it to light a candle that I could take with me to the bathroom. I know this sounds dumb, but it helped. The flame was like this weapon I had against the dark. So I went to the bathroom with my candle and put it on the counter next to the sink. When I was done, I raced back to my bedroom and jumped into bed. I didn't remember that the candle was still in the bathroom. I just fell asleep." Liv stopped and took a shaky breath, eyes never veering from the road. "When I woke up, it was dark, and my room was filled with smoke. I could barely breathe, and I was so terrified. I kept inhaling these huge lungfuls of ash. I cried out for my parents, but it was Peter who came into my room. He had Maisie, and he pushed open the window and dropped us out of it. That's when the fire reached my bedroom door. I could feel the heat from the flames from where I was sitting on the grass outside. Peter didn't have any choice but to jump through the window. He took Maisie and me, each by the hand, and led us to the street. The fire trucks appeared moments after, and I remember how happy I was to see them. How sure I was that they would put out the fire in my room, and then my parents would come out the front door and join us. They did put out the fire, but my parents never came outside. It wasn't until I was in an ambulance on the way to the hospital that I remembered the candle." Cedric had stayed completely silent throughout Liv's story. Toward the end, her voice sounded scratchy and harsh, as though she was trying not to cry. as though she were still choking on ash. He struggled to think of something to say, but nothing felt appropriate.
Liv, I am so sorry.
She cut him off with a wave of the hand. It was a long time ago, but every time I think of Peter and Maisie, all I can think of is how I ruined their lives, ruined everything. You were just a child who killed our parents, even if it was an accident. How could they ever forgive me for that? I don't think I'd be able to forgive someone for that. In fact, I know I couldn't. Cedric waited again. He wanted to reach out and take Liv's hand, but both of hers were clutched tight against the steering wheel. Her eyes didn't waver from the road. I don't know what I'd say if I ever saw them again. I don't know if I'd want to hear what they have to say to me. After a moment, Liv finally turned her head and looked at Cedric. Her eyes caught the glare of the sun, which was lowering itself past Cedric's window and lit up bright. He could see moisture border the edges of her eyes, but not a single tear fell.
I've never told anyone that story before, she said. Not even Shannon.
Cedric's mind raced as he tried to think of what to say. He finally just settled on the first thing that occurred to him.
Why tell me?
Liv paused before turning her attention back to the road.
I don't know. I really don't, she whispered.
The Rules of the Universe. The campus of UC San Diego was much bigger than Liv had anticipated. It took them at least a half hour before they were able to track down the history building, a squat brick structure with patches of old vines clinging to its front wall. Inside, Liv was surprised by how quiet it was, its halls nearly empty. She looked at a wall clock and saw it was nearly 7 p.m. The website said that his office hours end at 7. We have to hurry. Liv's voice sounded smaller than usual to her own ears. She felt hollowed out and raw, having spilled her guts to Cedric. Why had she shared that story with him? The lull of the car on the highway, the heat of the sun, the gentle way he'd asked her questions. Everything had just flowed out of her. After she'd finished talking, it had felt like waking up from a dream. Was it too late to take those words back? What could he possibly think of her now that he knew what she'd done? To have her deepest secret spoken aloud in the world, instead of held tight and safe inside of her, was unthinkable, as wrong as wearing her very nerves outside of her skin. But still, Liv pushed forward, through the university building's hallway to Professor Billings' office. Maybe she could will the conversation away by never thinking of it or acknowledging it again. At the professor's office door, Liv gave one last look to Cedric. He nodded and reached up to knock.
Come in, a voice called out.
The room was small and warm and cluttered with books. Four bookshelves of various sizes and designs lined the walls, and each was overflowing with large, leather-bound tomes, reference books, paperbacks with cracked spines. They spilled out of their shelves and onto the floor. They covered the cushions of a small love seat and curled around the legs of a worn desk. Professor Billings sat at the desk, looking slightly older than the picture on the UC San Diego website. His hair was whiter and his skin more lined, but his dark eyes were bright and vibrant. He carefully placed a bookmark between the pages of his book and set it aside as Liv and Cedric approached his desk.
I was beginning to think no one would take advantage of my office hours today, he said with a smile.
He looked them over more carefully and gestured for them to take the two seats in front of his desk.
Sorry, I can't seem to place you. Are you in my 11 a.m. class?
No, Cedric said as he sat. We are not pupils.
Liv shot him a quick look.
Well, we are pupils, I mean, students, she continued for him. Just not in your class.
Professor Billings raised one eyebrow, but said nothing.
We're actually here hoping you could shed some light on a subject we're interested in learning more about, Liv added, then cleared her throat, unsure how to begin.
Well,
We read that you know a lot about a mythical land called Kalem. And a set of scrolls that lead there, Cedric added. He sounded a little too eager, so Liv kicked him gently under the desk.
Well, Professor Billings said with a chuckle, this is a surprise. I haven't taught that particular lore in years. It's fairly obscure, you know.
But you wrote your dissertation on it. Professor Billings's eyebrows shot up in surprise.
You certainly have done your research.
Liv smiled and gave a half shrug.
Can I ask what brought about your interest? Most students who come to see me are here to bargain up their grades, not to hear more about my dissertation subject. And you look very young. Are you freshmen?
Cedric shifted in his seat, and Liv shot him a quick side glance. When I said students, I meant high school students from L.A. We're writing a research paper on ancient myths, and we happened across Kalem online, and we're really interested in it. But there's so little information out there, so we thought we'd come straight to the source.
Liv's voice trailed off, and she wondered if she'd just blown their chances. Why would a college professor care about a stupid high school project?
Professor Billings studied Liv's face for a moment, and she squirmed under his gaze. But then his expression cleared, and he smiled an easy smile once again.
Well, it's nice to see high school students so interested in the lesser-known historical myths, he said warmly.
What in particular would you like to know about?
The scrolls, Cedric cut in. Professor Billings nodded. Well, to understand about the scrolls, you really need a background of the legend. Written accounts of Kalem can be traced back to the early 13th century, although its oral history began before that time. It was at its most pervasive around the same era as the Knights of the Round Table and all of that business, sort of medieval Britain's latent response to...
Sorry, is this boring you?
No, Cedric said quickly. Well, let me know if I get too dry. I tend to go on sometimes, he said, smiling and leaning back in his chair. Anyhow, the legend begins with the once widely held belief that devils roamed the earth, spreading terror and destruction. Mostly ruining crops and taking firstborn babies, that kind of thing. Some cultures refer to them as evil spirits or sprites or rats.
Cedric sat up straighter, and Liv wished she could tell him to chill out. The professor didn't seem to notice, however.
According to this particular lore, these creatures have been on this planet in some form or another since its creation. In response to their growing numbers, a group of men banded together and mixed their bloodlines with those of the rats in order to incorporate some of their otherworldly strength for the purpose of fighting them.
That's not true, Cedric burst out, jumping out of his seat. He bumped against the desk and disrupted some nearby papers as well as a small bronze figurine. The trinket swayed on its stand, coming perilously close to toppling before the professor reached over and steadied it. He looked at Cedric, a bit discomfited.
Well, obviously none of it is really true, son.
Sorry, Liv interrupted. He gets really excited about ancient myths. She made a motion for Cedric to sit down, and he reluctantly did.
I can understand that, I suppose. After all, these ancient stories are nothing but metaphors for how we live our lives. In this instance, it's a metaphor for how good men must necessarily become corrupted in some way in order to be strong enough to protect their people. To fight devils, man must become part devil himself. Quite fascinating, really.
Liv did her best to look fascinated, while the professor continued. So, with their tainted blood, these mythical men had the strength necessary to fight off the scores of wraths. At first, they acted in secret, but over the centuries, other groups of men joined in the fight against the wraths, scholars and religious sects, mostly. They wanted to find a way to not only fight the wraths off, but to expel them from this world for good. And then, according to legend, they did. They found a way to send the wraths somewhere else.
Kalem, Cedric whispered. His tone was hushed,
almost reverential.
Professor Billings nodded.
That's right. You know the story?
We'd still like to hear it from you, if that's okay, Liv said after Cedric didn't respond. For our assignment.
The professor nodded again and continued.
One particular sect was known as the Knights of Valair, and they were believed to have true mystics in their midst. Sorcerers, you know.
Sorcerers? Liv asked. You mean as in wizards and magic and all that?
You could say that. Myths of sorcerers certainly abounded during that time. Just look at Merlin.
But Merlin's fictional, Liv said without thinking. I mean, I guess all this stuff is fictional, she added, trailing off.
But really, she wondered how many other fictional things actually fell in the nonfiction category. After everything she'd seen the last 2 days, anything was possible. For all she knew, the North Pole was real and Santa Claus was up there right now, making presents for all the nice children of Los Angeles, or holding onto a set of mythical scrolls.
The professor leaned forward, his words picking up the pace as he continued.
We know that now, but at one time, people really believed these legends were true, the documented accounts of wraiths and the superpowered men, who were referred to as guardians, tapered off around the same time that stories of magic drifted into the stuff of legend. Most historians agree that advancing technology allowed human beings to become more rational, more able to explain the phenomena around us, and less likely to write it off as magic.
Liv nodded, trying to follow along.
There is another theory, however, the professor continued, put forth by, I'll admit, mostly discredited historians, who believe that magic does exist, that it has existed in some form on Earth since the beginning of time. These historians believe that centuries ago, around the time the Guardians left Earth, the planet became overwhelmed by magic and developed a negative reaction to it. So it went into sort of a survival mode, you see, by hiding magic or expelling magic when necessary. A type of evolutionary response. It's called the quelling theory. Similar to the way different species evolve and adapt in order to survive, the Earth evolved to get rid of its magic when it became too powerful and too dangerous. The quelling theory might explain why the Knights of Valair were able to banish the Wraiths and Guardians from Earth when they did. The Wraiths posed a threat to the planet's existence and had to be expelled, so when the Knights went looking for the means to banish the Wraiths, the planet supplied it. They were able to craft a series of scrolls that opened up a portal to another world, and they used that portal to push all the Wraiths through.
Just pushed through? Like some sort of mystical trash chute?
A trash chute! Professor Billings chortled. He leaned back in his chair and looked at Liv, almost wonderingly.
Yes, that's perfect. Mind if I write it down?
Liv shrugged and ignored the angry glare Cedric was aiming in her direction. The professor's story was shaking out a little differently than the one Cedric had shared with her about his people finding the portal and leaving the hell dimension of Earth behind.
Anyway, the professor continued,
the portal also had an unintended effect. Instead of just drawing out all wraiths, it drew out all living things with wrath energy or wrath blood. The Earth's protective magic-quelling instincts went into overdrive, so to speak. And thus the Guardians disappeared forever, too, along with much of Earth's magic, of course.
For a moment, the room was silent. Professor Billings seemed lost in thought, staring down at his folded hands.
It was Cedric who eventually spoke up, his voice strained.
What about the scrolls? What happened to them?
Professor Billings threw up his hands and shrugged.
The same as what happened to the Holy Grail, I'd expect. They're lost to time, if they ever existed at all.
The professor put one finger into the air. But he turned around in his seat and started to rummage through a filing cabinet behind his desk. He opened and flipped through drawer after drawer, finally letting out an exclamation and pulling up a manila folder. You might find this of interest for your report, he said, putting the folder down on the desk. Liv almost asked him what report he meant before she remembered their bogus cover story. What is it? I bought it at an auction some years back, but have never been able to authenticate it. It's a document connected to the Knights of Valair, rumored to be a partial copy of the scrolls in question. Liv's eyebrows furrowed. I thought you said they were just legend. Mystical scrolls that can open a portal to another world? Those are legend. But the Knights of Valair were a real sect, and they left real artifacts behind. Whether or not we can read them is another matter. Cedric leaned forward eagerly, just barely stopping himself from bumping against the desk edge again. Can I see it? He asked, gazing down at the manila folder with an eager expression. Of course. Liv braced herself. She didn't even notice that she was holding her own breath as Professor Billings flipped over the front of the manila folder with a flourish. Although she didn't know what she had been expecting, the plain sheaf of slightly yellowed copy paper was a bit of a letdown. At first, she could only make out faint scribbled lines in an unknown language, but then they came together to form a sort of pattern, an eerily recognizable pattern. At the bottom of the page, one line of the text caught her eyes. She had no idea what it meant, and yet it was as familiar to her as her own skin. Her skin! Liv rocked back in her chair, as black dots swam in front of her eyes. The professor droned on about an authentication process, but it seemed as if his words were coming from another room, from another place entirely. The marks at the bottom of the paper, she'd seen them before. Unconsciously, Liv reached a trembling hand up over her shoulder and under her thin hoodie, barely touching it against the hollow between her shoulder blades. She rubbed her fingers there, lightly, over the place where she knew her tattoo to be. The tattoo that bore the exact same foreign marks, in the exact same order as the ones printed on the yellow papers below. The Lonely Inn. Liv heard blood rushing in her ears. She understood with a dim sort of awareness that Cedric and Professor Billings were still talking, but their words didn't penetrate the cloud that had fallen over her. It didn't make any sense. It couldn't be true. And yet it was. The figures on the paper in front of her were an exact replica of the tattoo she'd had for years, the one she never talked about. Because no matter what Shannon might think, the tattoo wasn't a symbol of her hidden wild child nature. Instead, it represented what she hated most about being a foster kid and having such little control over her life, even her own body. Are you all right? Cedric's voice cut through the fog. She looked over at him and saw concern flicker across his blue eyes. Yeah, it's just... Liv looked over at the professor, who also seemed concerned, his hands spread across the replica of scrolls on the desk. Was it possible that she had found the one man who could finally explain what the symbols of her tattoo meant? And if it was somehow connected to Calum, she had to take this chance. I have to show you something. Before she could lose her nerve, Liv twisted around in her seat and drew her jacket off. She pushed the straps of her tank top down, giving Cedric and the professor the best view of her shoulder blades. She heard Cedric make a sound behind her, sort of a quick exhalation of breath, but didn't turn around to face him. Oh, my, the professor murmured. She heard the rustling of paper and knew that one of them was lifting up the copy of the scrolls, comparing it to her back, but she didn't need to look at it again. She'd long ago memorized the strange slashes and swooping lines that crawled just over her shoulder blades in a straight line. Young lady, where did you get that? The professor asked. I don't remember physically getting it. I just remember what happened afterward. I was so young, and it was right after my parents died.
My memories from then are hazy. All I know is my first foster parents were these religious nuts. They're the ones who gave me the tattoo. As soon as my caseworker found out about it, he pulled me out of there. Liv trailed off, thinking of the few memories she had from that time. She had been so young and so deep in grief over her parents, but she remembered Mrs. Hannigan in her tight bun and floor-length skirts, Mr. Hannigan with the thick Bible he read from every night. She remembered scouring the floors in her bedroom because cleanliness was next to godliness. She remembered the way they used to look at her, like she was something dirty. And she remembered the day Joe came and got in a huge fight with the Hannigans, screaming at them about the tattoo before picking her up and swooping her out of there forever. In the years since, she'd asked Joe about it, but all he'd told her was that the Hannigans wouldn't ever hurt her again. She'd been saving up money to get the tattoo removed as soon as she turned 18. Cedric was silent. Liv suddenly felt self-conscious and pulled her tank top strap back up. She sneaked a look at Cedric, but his expression was hard to read. "It's quite unusual," Professor Billings whispered. That, Liv knew. She'd heard it said so many times in her life, mostly from foster parents who thought it was strange that so young a child had a tattoo. Many of them were creeped out by it, and Liv had always secretly thought that it was one of the reasons she'd never been asked to stay in any one family for very long. Shannon teased her about it, of course. Some other classmates had asked her about it as well, passing acquaintances and boys she'd gone out with for small stretches at a time. They saw it, and they always asked her the same question. What did it mean? And she'd smile in what she hoped was a mysterious way and shrug. It's a secret. And it was a secret, from everyone and from her, too. Only the nutbag Hannigans knew what the tattoo meant, and she certainly never planned to track them down and ask them. She'd always assumed it was some weird religious thing. "Is this why you came to see me?" the professor asked. "No," Liv whispered, head spinning. "I know it sounds crazy, but I've never seen anything like my tattoo until just now. I've never even known what it means." The professor's eyebrows raised. "Quite a coincidence," he murmured. "Yes, it is," Cedric said. His eyes weren't on Liv, but were focused on the floor, as though he was thinking hard. "How did you say you heard about the legend of Calum again?" the professor asked. Liv felt stuck. She couldn't tell the professor the real reason they'd come to visit him without making Cedric look crazy, and she couldn't convince Cedric that she'd had no idea her tattoo was in any way connected to his home realm with the professor sitting right there. She had to think quickly. "I saw it online," Liv said. She avoided looking over at Cedric, but hoped he would go along with the story. "It just sounded really interesting." The professor still looked skeptical. "Maybe reading about it kind of reminded me of my first foster parents in some way," Liv lied. "Because the legend's so crazy and they were so crazy." Then something occurred to her. She sat up straighter. "They were really into random Bible passages and weird stuff. Do you think maybe they believed in that group? The Knights of whatever, the ones who wrote that?" She gestured to the marked piece of paper on the professor's desk. "Maybe that's why they put this thing on me." The professor looked at her with sympathy. "Hmm. It's possible, though the legend of Calum isn't associated with any modern religion, and I certainly don't know how it would compel them to mark a child in that way." Liv could feel the answer slipping away and realized with a sharp pang how much she wanted them. "And you don't know what exactly it means? The tattoo?" He drew in a breath. "That's part of the reason this copy hasn't been able to be authenticated. See? Because it matches no complete written language that scholars can find. Snatches of these symbols have been found here and there, but nothing to really cling to. It's a language out of time." The professor sighed and moved the papers closer, shaking his head a little as he looked down at them.
I have an associate, the professor said, looking off and scratching his chin. He also has a minor archive of documents related to the scrolls and the legend. I could give him a call, maybe see if he could provide any additional information.
Liv's heart jumped with hope again. That would be great. The professor stood, and numbly, Liv followed. Cedric rose too, scraping his chair back against the floor.
I'll call him tonight. Maybe you could drop by tomorrow morning? My first class is at 10 a.m., so any time before then.
Liv and Cedric exchanged a quick glance, but there was no need for discussion. They both nodded.
We'll come back, Cedric said.
The professor shook Cedric's hand and then Liv's. He pressed his hand against hers for an extra beat, looking right into her eyes.
It was really nice to meet you.
When he smiled, his eyes crinkled in the corners.
You too,
Liv said, trying to manage a smile as well. She and Cedric stepped out of the office, and the professor shut the door behind them. They stood alone in the hallway, which seemed emptier and darker than before. A fluorescent light flickered overhead. Without saying a word, Cedric moved toward the exit, and Liv followed. Liv figured it would be much easier for them to find a cheap motel in San Diego than to try and drive all the way home, only to turn around and drive the 2.5 hours back the next morning. She didn't want to admit it to Cedric, but she was pretty sure the professor was only being nice and really wouldn't have any more information to share with them the next day. If anything, he was probably just as weirded out as she was. But heading home now without making absolutely sure was not an option. They drove around for about 20 minutes until they were able to find a motel off the highway that was small and seedy enough to not ask for a driver's license or credit card information. Not only was Liv under 18, but she knew there was a possibility Joe had put a watch on her debit card to try and track her down. Liv used the rest of her cash to pay for the room and scrounge up a dinner from the motel's vending machines. She and Cedric sat on one edge of the room's twin beds, facing the only window, and silently divvied up the food between them. They hadn't spoken much since leaving the professor's office, which had been fine as long as they were in a car that could be filled with radio music. But once they were alone in the small room with its dingy walls, the quiet fell heavily around them.
"Do you think the others will worry when we don't come back tonight?" Liv asked, as she opened up a bag of pretzels.
Cedric's brows knitted together for an instant, but then relaxed.
They might, but Kat will know to stay put until I return. I only wish I knew how she was faring on her mission.
Liv nodded. We should probably get everyone disposable cell phones. Cheap, but they work.
I'm not sure we would know what to do with them.
I could show you. Cedric nodded absently and chewed slowly on an Oreo. After a moment, he put the cookie down and turned to Liv. His normally bright eyes looked dark in the dim light of the room.
Tell me just one more time about your back.
Liv sighed. I told you everything I know, and trust me, it's not much.
You never thought it strange that this family would brand you in that way.
Liv pushed the bag of pretzels away from her, suddenly not hungry anymore.
Of course it's strange, but it's just one strange thing in the long list of strange things that is my life. I am sorry. I did not mean to offend.
Liv's eyes dropped to the remaining junk food wrappers that rested between them.
I know you didn't, but I really must ask you. For so long, all we have been trying to do here is to find the scrolls so we can get home. And we have hit nothing but dead ends. Then I discovered the first person we saw upon entering this realm just happens to have text from the scrolls printed on her back and...
Liv crossed her arm protectively across her chest, suddenly wanting to look away.
Spit it out. Ask what you want to ask.
He took a big breath before continuing.